Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammāsambuddhassa. Okay, good evening, everybody. Last week we started to study Sutta number 33 in the Majjhima Nikaya. This is called the Mahakopalaka Sutta, the Greater Discourse on the Cowherd. And in discussing this sutta, I began right off with paragraph 15. In the sutta, the Buddha explains 11 ways in which a cowherd is incapable of taking care of a herd of cattle. And then he uses these 11 terms as points of comparison with a monk who is incapable of growth, progress, and fulfillment in the Dhamma and discipline. And then the Buddha explains or elaborates on each of these 11 ways in which a monk fails in the Dhamma. Okay, then in paragraph 15, the Buddha explains how when a cowherd possesses 11 qualities, then he's capable of looking after a herd of cattle. The Buddha mentions the 11 qualities. And then in the next paragraph, the Buddha draws out the analogy, the comparison, by enumerating 11 ways in which a monk is capable of growth, progress, and fulfillment in the Dhamma and discipline. He uses the same terms that he used when describing the cowherd, the competent cowherd. Then he explains each of these points, giving it a meaning derived from the Dhamma. And so last week we took the first of these, which is knowledge. The monk, like the cowherd, has to have knowledge of form, which in the case of the monk means knowledge, understanding of the nature of materiality, of material form. Understanding all material form as consisting of the four great elements and the types of matter derived from the four great elements. The second is being skilled in characteristics, which means knowing how a fool is characterized by his actions and how a wise person is characterized by his actions. The third is picking out fly's eggs, which means that the monk doesn't tolerate arisen unwholesome thoughts, but abandons them and eliminates them. And then the fourth is dressing wounds, which in the case of the monk means guarding the doors of the sense faculties so that the mind doesn't grasp upon the signs and qualities, signs and features of things. Okay, so that is what we covered last week. Now we will go on and complete the sutta. Okay, so the fifth quality of the capable cowherd is that he smokes out the sheds, the cowsheds. I guess the cowsheds get filled with flies over time, and also maybe the urine and the excrement of the cows, they have to be cleaned out. And then to clean out the smell of the sheds, the cowherd has to smoke the sheds. This is my assumption. I really don't know anything about looking after cows. Okay, and so when we apply this quality to the monk. How is it that a monk smokes out the sheds? And here the Buddha says the monk teaches in detail, teach others in detail the Dhamma as he has learned it and mastered it. I have to confess, I don't see very clearly the connection between teaching the Dhamma and smoking out sheds. Anybody who has experience with cows? Is there anybody here who can give some hint as to the connection?
Well, maybe the Dhamma is a way of sort of cleaning out or clearing up or taking away impurities.
Oh, that's a good idea. A good suggestion. Maybe the way the smoke clears out the flies, the bad odors within the shed. So teaching the Dhamma is able to sort of smoke out the defilements in the minds of others. In any case, this particular paragraph here shows that the Buddha places emphasis on the need for teaching the Dhamma, and not simply teaching it, but teaching it in detail, the Buddha says, in detail. And then he uses two words to indicate the process of learning. In Pali, it's yatha sutang, yatha pariyatang. Sutang actually means hearing, as one has heard it. So this is like the first stage in the process of learning is to hear the Dhamma. In the Buddha's day, texts or the Buddha's discourses were not written down in the form of books. The teaching was always transmitted orally. And so in order to learn the Dhamma, one has to live in the presence of the Buddha or of very learned monks and nuns, and listen to them teach the Dhamma. So first one listens, and then comes yatha pariyatang. This pariyatang implies mastering the teaching. And what is involved in mastering is that after one has learned the teaching by listening, then one has to memorize the teaching. Get it by memory. If not word for word, but one has to get the main topics in the teaching by memory. Then one has to practice recitation. This is part of the process of memorization, is to recite out loud. Because when one recites out loud, that impresses the teaching upon the mind so that one can retain it better. And even in these days when we have printed books, but in the traditional Buddhist countries, monks still learn the teaching by memory and by recitation. So that, for example, in Burma today, there are several monks who have memorized, who know by memory, the entire Tripitaka. That's some 40 volumes. Even my own teacher, he used to, in his training when he was a young monk in Sri Lanka, he was taught to memorize the teachings. So he learned several volumes by memory. And then when he was interested in learning English, he used to correspond with Mrs. Rhys Davids, who at that time was the president of the Pali Text Society. And she sent him some of her volumes of translation from the Sutta Pitaka, published by the Pali Text Society. And the way he learned English was to memorize these volumes that she sent. And so he spoke a very good British English. Okay, so one memorizes, recites out loud as a way of reinforcing the memorization. Then one has to examine the meaning in order to understand the meaning. And then after understanding the meaning through reflection and examination, then ideally one has to put the teaching into practice and then penetrate it by direct insight. Okay, so after one learns the teaching and then masters it, at least to some extent, then one continues the heritage of the teaching, the heritage of the Dhamma, by teaching the Dhamma to others in detail. Okay, then we come to the next point, which is knowing the watering place. This is quite clear in the case of the cowherd looking after the herd of cattle. The cows have to drink from time to time, and so the cowherd has to lead them, guide them to the watering place. And so in the case of the monk, it's interesting here, the Pali word for the watering place is titta, which actually means a ford. It's also, it's a place where one crosses the river. In the Sanskrit, the equivalent is tirtha. And in Indian spirituality, the word titta takes on a special meaning of being a spiritual teaching, a body of doctrines and practices, which one uses as a means for crossing over the river or ocean, the river, the stream of samsara, of birth and death. And so a spiritual school or a religious sect in India during the Buddha's time was known sometimes as a Tithayatana. It means a place for crossing the ford. It means a ford, a place for crossing the stream. And so here it's natural that those who are very learned in the tradition should be compared to a titta, that's a place for crossing over. Okay, and so the Buddha explains now how a monk knows the watering place, or the ford for crossing over. And the Buddha explains here, a monk goes from time to time to those bhikkhus who have learnt much, who are well-versed in the tradition, who uphold, maintain the Dhamma, the Vinaya, and then the text uses a word here, which is translated as the codes. The Pali word for this is matika. Okay, so we have the monks who uphold or maintain the Dhamma, that's the doctrine. Then the discipline, this is in Pali, this is Vinaya, which in time, over time, came to designate the body of monastic rules and regulations. I think probably in the earliest phase of Buddhism, Vinaya or discipline meant simply the practice, the whole practice that led to liberation, whereas the Dhamma would be the doctrine. But over time, the word Dhamma came to designate the suttas or discourses of the Buddha, and then Vinaya or discipline came to designate the body of monastic rules with their explanations and the various regulations governing the monastic orders. Then the third term is used here is the codes, which in Pali is matika. And these codes came to play a very important role in the development of Buddhist thought. The codes were probably summaries of the doctrine in the form of lists. These would be lists of, for example, the 37 factors of enlightenment, or 37 aids to enlightenment. Things like doctrinal principles, like the five aggregates, the 12 sense bases, the 18 elements, the 12 factors of dependent origination, the Four Noble Truths. So these were outlines of the main points of the doctrine. And what happened over time to the matikas? The matikas became, this is according to the opinion of modern scholars, the matikas became the origin of that branch of teaching, Buddha's teaching, called the Abhidhamma. Because as the matikas were passed on from generation to generation, learned monks would start to elaborate on the matikas to provide them, each of the main terms, with definitions, explanations. And so originally the matikas were probably a condensation of the teaching, a summary of the teaching. But as the matikas came to be explained in detail, elaborated, worked into a system, they became bigger and bigger until they turned into an extremely complicated, elaborate systematization of the teaching. And that is what we call the Abhidhamma. Okay, so from this passage we see that sort of the ideal for the learned monk is to know the Dhamma, the discipline, and these codes, that the matika. And so when a monk has questions, then he goes to these learned monks and asks questions of them, asking, how is this? What is the meaning of this? And then these elder learned monks reveal to them what has not been revealed. They clarify what is not clear, and they remove his doubts about the various things that give rise to doubt. Okay, so this aspect also shows another side to the teaching of the Dhamma, except in paragraph 21, where the monk is smoking out the sheds, this is where a monk, after learning the Dhamma, takes the initiative in teaching it to others. But in the case of knowing the watering place, here we have a monk who has many doubts, questions, doesn't know how to resolve them on his own. And so he seeks out those elder monks who are highly learned and questions them in order to get his doubts dispelled. Okay, we go on to paragraph 23. How does a bhikkhu know what it is to have drunk? Okay, now the answer that the Buddha gives is that when the Dhamma and discipline proclaimed by the Tathagata is being taught, a monk gains, here we have a special word, I'll write it on the board, he gains inspiration in the meaning, he gains inspiration in the Dhamma, he gains gladness connected with the Dhamma. We have two important expressions here. These two expressions are Uttaveda, which is translated here, inspiration in the meaning, and Dhammaveda, which is translated inspiration in the Dhamma. And then the key word here is the word Veda, translated very roughly as inspiration. And now, if you know anything about Indian religious history, then you know that sort of the root scriptures of the Indian spirituality within the fold of Brahmanism are called the Vedas. The Vedas are taken by the Brahmins and then later by all later Hindu philosophers and religious thinkers to be divinely revealed sacred scriptures. They are, you could say, the Vedas for the Brahmins are the voice of Brahma, the voice of the divine reality. The Buddha, of course, as a non-Brahminic religious teacher, did not accept the authority of the Vedas. In fact, we could say the Buddha, along with the founder of Jainism, Mahavira, was a rebel against the authority, the authoritarianism of the Vedas. But the Buddha took over this word Veda and then gave it a meaning within his own system where, let's say first that the root of the word Veda is vid, which means to know. Okay, so the root of the word Veda is vid, which means to know. And thus from this root vid, we get the word vijja, which plays the important role in Buddhism. Vijja is higher knowledge, liberating knowledge. And this is contrasted with its opposite. What is the opposite of vijja? Avijja, which means ignorance. Okay, so one nuance, one meaning within this word Veda is knowledge. But in the Buddhist text, from the same root vid, we also get the noun vedana. Vedana means feeling. So the word Veda suggests both knowledge and feeling. You could say it's a knowledge which is infused with feeling, or it's a feeling which originates from knowledge. The two ideas of knowledge and feeling are both integrated within this one word, Veda, which is what makes it difficult to translate adequately into English. And so I'm not sure whether it was Venerable Nyanamoli or I myself who came up with inspiration. But that's what is used in this translation. So when listening to the Dhamma, we could say that the monk, as he comes to understand it, to gain some insight into it, then he feels uplifted, excited, motivated, or we can say inspired. And then we also have in this expression, attaveda, the word atta also has two meanings, or even three meanings. One meaning of atta is, in fact, meaning. So atta means meaning. And that's the way it's translated here. But atta also means good. Good or benefit. And then from this meaning of good or benefit, there comes the third meaning, which is the goal or purpose. And so all of these three ideas are compressed within this word, atta. And so as one is listening, as one understands the meaning, one feels inspired. As one recognizes the good or benefit, one feels inspired. And as one comes to gain some sense of the goal, one feels inspired. Okay, and often we get this Attaveda and Dhammaveda paired together. It seems inspiration in the Dhamma is the inspiration that comes directly from the doctrine, understanding the doctrine, whereas inspiration in the meaning comes, is what comes from understanding the meaning of the doctrine or from experiencing the benefits of the doctrine. Okay, and then closely connected with this is gaining gladness or joy connected with the Dhamma. And so this is said to be like drinking because it's an experience. Sometimes we say that as he is sitting there, one drinks in the teaching. In the Dhammapada, we have the verse Dhamma Piti Sukhang Seti. Because Anavi Lena Chetasa, one who drinks in the Dhamma, sleeps peacefully or lives happily with a clear, undefiled mind. Okay, so this is how a monk knows what it is to have drunk. Okay, now after the cows have drunk the water at the watering place, the cowherd has to lead them back to the pasture. And in order to lead them back, what does he have to know? He has to know the road. Okay, so this seems to be actually constituting something of a pattern here. These, one listens to the Dhamma, one clarifies doubts by asking elder monks one's questions, then one listens to the Dhamma and gains the inspiration. Then one has to put what one learns into practice by following the road, following the path. And then that path is the Noble Eightfold Path. Okay, we've explained the Noble Eightfold Path several times in the past, so I'm not going to explain it now. But this is, in a general way, the path of practice. And as one proceeds along this Noble Eightfold Path, one eventually comes to the pastures. Here the word pasture, again there's a play on words, is gochara. Yeah, the word gochara is actually a compound of two parts. The word go means cow, and chara means to move about. So the pasture is a place where the cows move about. That's the original sense of gochara. But the word gochara came to be used in Buddhism to mean the place where the mind moves about. So it takes on the extended meaning of, you could say, the objects of the mind, or the area in which the mind moves about. And so it's said that one has to avoid a bad gochara and stick to a proper or good gochara, the proper pasture. And then there are several suttas in the Saṅyutta Nikāya. This is in the chapter on Satipatthana, Satipatthana Saṅyutta, chapter 47, in which the Buddha speaks about the four foundations of mindfulness, the four Satipatthanas, as being the proper gochara, the proper pasture for a monk in training. Okay, so here the Buddha applies, here the Buddha uses this wordplay of the word gochara, which on the one hand means the pasture where a cow goes to graze, and also it means the object of the mind, especially the proper object of the mind for one in training. And he designates this proper domain of the mind to be the four foundations of mindfulness. Okay, the next quality, it's said that the cowherd, when he's taking care of the cows, he should not milk them dry. Again, I don't have experience looking after cows. I don't know the reason for that. But there must be some reason why the cowherd should not completely milk the cows so that all of the milk is extracted. And similarly, it's said that it's proper for the monk not to milk dry. And what is meant by this? Here, the Buddha points out that what often happens is that lay people with faith and with devotion to the Sangha invite a monk to take as much as he likes of robes, alms food, resting places, and medicinal requisites. So they will say, if you need a robe, please let me know. I will be happy to provide a robe. If you need a meal, please let me know. I'll be happy to prepare a meal for you. If you need a place to live, let me know, and I'll be happy to arrange to build maybe a hut for you or to provide medicines for you. So in this case, the Buddha says, it's quite appropriate for the monk to accept this offer from the lay people. It's a way of giving the lay people a chance to acquire punya or meritorious karma by making the offerings. But the Buddha says, when one accepts, one has to also recognize that lay people provide these things from money that they earn or from their own property, their own possessions. And so one should not take advantage of them by making excessive demands. If you need a robe, okay, accept a robe, but don't say, I'd like to have 5 or 6 robes. I like one sort of brownish, what do you call this, a burgundy color like this. I also like, when I go to town, to wear a copper-colored robe. And maybe I have one, a little brownish robe, and then one bright red for when I go out on the town. So one doesn't make excessive demands. If one asks for a meal, one should not say, this is my menu, please serve me caviar from Okay, so one has to be moderate in accepting things that are being offered by householders. Okay, and then we come to point 11, which is called, okay, in relation to the cowherd shows extra veneration to those bulls who are the fathers and leaders of the herd. That is, the cowherd has to give special consideration to the elder bulls, since they're the leaders. He shouldn't neglect them. And so in relation to the monk, the Buddha says the monk should show extra veneration to those elder bhikkhus of long standing who have long gone forth, the fathers and leaders of the Sangha. And how does he do so? This is done through loving kindness, by showing loving kindness towards the elders through one's bodily actions, taking care of them, providing them with things that they need, helping them look after, take care of their daily tasks. If they have difficulty shaving them, helping them take bath, providing them with food. So we could see the way Venerable Guoqing looks after Shifu, again with bodily acts of loving kindness. Okay, and then second way is through verbal acts of loving kindness, speaking to them politely, respectfully, gently, and then maintaining mental acts of loving kindness towards them. That is, by developing the thoughts, the mind of loving kindness towards them. Okay, and so that is showing extra veneration to the elders in the Sangha. Okay, and then the Buddha concludes by saying, when a bhikkhu possesses these 11 qualities, then he's capable of growth, progress, and fulfillment in this Dhamma and discipline. Okay, now we finished. I'll ask whether there's any questions. Okay, Peter?
The word atta, which means meaning, but also means good, benefit, goal, or purpose. This reminds me of a discussion in Aristotle, the Nicomachean Ethics, where he talks about ends and goods and purposes and goals as all sort of the same. And I'm wondering if the meaning of the word atta, which can mean good, it's good in the sense of what was the good of that action, as opposed to morally good?
It's good in the first sense. What is the good of that action, rather than moral good? Moral good, I think the word that would be used in Pali would be kalyana. Yeah. Or even kusala, you could say. Kusala or kalyana. Okay, George?
This is the first sutta where I run into the word, the code. I don't recall seeing it elsewhere.
We haven't come across this word, matika, previously. Let me just take a quick look in the index. In fact, it's not indexed. I'm not sure whether it occurs elsewhere in the Majjhima Nikaya. I know it occurs in several suttas in the Anguttara Nikaya. I don't think so, because definitely I think that the word matika would have been used by the Buddha during his lifetime. It could have been towards the later part of his lifetime where these lists of technical terms or of doctrinal terms had been compiled into some kind of body that was transmitted. We have to remember, in this period, I said that the matika is the source of the Abhidhamma, but this doesn't mean that the Abhidhamma, as we know it, had existed during the Buddha's time. Of course, the texts do use the expression Abhidhamma, but not in the sense of this codified body of teachings. Any further questions? Okay, if no further questions, then I want to just go rather quickly through the next sutta. This is called the Chula Gopalika Sutta, the shorter discourse on the cowherd. Okay, and this also begins with a simile. Again, there's a contrast between two types of cowherd. One is the foolish cowherd, and the other is the wise cowherd. And the Buddha speaks about a foolish Magadhan cowherd. Magadha was a major state in northern India, the state where the Buddha gave most of his teachings, or many of his teachings. Okay, and so there's a foolish cowherd who in the last month of the rainy season, during the last month of the rainy season, the rivers have been swollen with the rain that has been falling throughout the rainy season. So the rivers have been they're wide and they're deep and perhaps even violent with the current. And so now this cowherd, without examining the near shore or the further shore of the river, drives his cattle across to the other shore at a place that has no ford. And as a consequence, what happens when they get to midstream? Then the cattle are all swept together and they meet with calamity and disaster. Okay, so then the Buddha compares us to those ascetics and Brahmins who are unskilled in this world. This world is like the near shore of the river. And they are unskilled in the other world, the world beyond. So this would be in the next life. They're unskilled in Mara's realm. What is Mara's realm? What is Mara's realm? We say death, but Mara is death, but what is the realm over which death reigns? Yeah, or the familiar samsara, it's samsara. And unskilled in what is outside Mara's realm. What is outside Mara's realm, or we could say, all of the world transcending, supramundane states. The noble path, the fruit, and Nibbana. Then basically the same thing, unskilled in the realm of death, unskilled in what is outside or beyond the realm of death. Okay, so those who place trust in them and follow them, the Buddha says it will lead to their harm and suffering for a long time. Okay, then we come to the counterpart. This is the wise cowherd who in the last month of the rainy season in the autumn, he has to conduct his cattle across the river. But this cowherd examines the near shore and the far shore of the river. And of course he'll choose a place where the near shore and the far shore are close together, not a very wide part of the river. And he drives his cattle across to the other shore at a place that has a ford, that is a place which is not overwhelmed with water, but where the cattle can walk across. Then as he guides the cattle across, he follows a particular order. He first leads the bulls across. Again, as in the previous sutta, these are the fathers and leaders of the herd. So they enter first, then they breast the stream and they get safely across. Then he makes the strong cattle and the cattle to be tamed enter next. They get across. Then he leads the heifers and the young oxen across. And then he makes the calves and the feeble cattle go across next, and they get safely across. And then the Buddha adds another type of cow. He says, at the time there was a tender calf just born, being urged on by its mother's lowing, and it too breasted the stream of the Ganges and got safely across to the further shore. And how is this possible? And that is because the wise cowherd examined the near shore, examined the further shore, and then drove his cattle across at the place that had a ford. Okay, so now the Buddha fulfills or fills in the simile. He says, applies the simile. He says, as to those recluses and Brahmins who are skilled in this world and skilled in the other world. They know the nature of this world. They know the nature of the other world. By the other world would be, for example, the heavenly realm or a happy rebirth in the human realm. Then they're skilled in Mara's realm. They know the nature of all samsara and what is outside Mara's realm, what is beyond samsara. This would be the noble path, the fruits, and nibbana. They're skilled in the realm of death, skilled in what is outside the realm of death. And so for those who have trust in them and place faith in them, this will lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Okay, and then the Buddha further fills in or applies the simile. In paragraph 6, the bulls and fathers, the fathers and leaders of the herd who got across, those are like the arhats who have destroyed all of the defilements and so on, reached their own goal. These have gotten safely across to the further shore. They have gotten beyond the stream or river of samsara, and they've reached safety. They've arrived at nibbana. Then the strong cattle, the cattle to be tamed, okay, they get safely across to the further shore. And so here the Buddha compares them to those monks who, with the destruction of the five lower fetters, reappear or they're reborn spontaneously in the pure abodes, and attain final nibbana there without ever returning from that world. And then he says, by breasting Mara's stream, this is what makes better sense, they will get safely across to the far shore. They're not across yet. They're still partly in the stream, but they're definitely bound to get across to the far shore. Then compared to the hyphens and the young oxen who get across the stream, the Buddha compares the monks who have destroyed the three fetters. They have weakened lust, hatred, and delusion. And these are the once-returners who come back once more to this world to make an end of suffering. And then the Buddha says, they too will get safely across to the further shore. Again, they're not across yet, but they're bound to get safely across. Then the weakest cattle are the calves and the feeble cattle. And just as they get safely across to the far shore, so those monks who, with the destruction of three fetters, become stream enterers, these are the sotapannas, they're heading for enlightenment. And by breasting Mara's stream, they too will get safely across to the further shore. For them, it might take at most seven lives. It could be three or four lives, even one or two lives, but they're bound to get safely across. And then we have what the Buddha called the tender calf who has just been born, who will get across the stream to the far shore. Who is this tender calf just born compared to? Here the Buddha says that this calf is like those who are Dhamma followers and faith followers. Here there are technical terms. Okay, these are two types of disciples who have not yet become stream enterers, sotapannas, but they have gone beyond or transcended the level of what we call the ordinary person or puttujana. They are noble persons, Aryan persons, persons who have reached the stage, the plane of the noble ones. And they are bound to reach at least the stage of sotapanna, the stage of stream entry within this life itself. The two types differ with regard to their dominant faculty. The Dhamma follower is the one for whom panya, wisdom, is the dominant faculty. And so the Dhamma follower is one who penetrates into the Dhamma through wisdom. The Sadanusari, this is the faith follower. The faith follower also penetrates into the Dhamma through wisdom. The only way to get actually into the fold of the Dhamma is through wisdom. But the wisdom of the faith follower is not as strong, not as sharp as the wisdom of the Dhamma follower. The faith follower is the person, but let me distinguish them in this way, the way I understand it. The Dhamma follower is the person whose motivating urge is to understand the truth. And so the Dhamma follower is one who uses wisdom to investigate deeply and in detail the nature of the Dhamma, the nature of reality. The faith follower also has to use wisdom to investigate the nature of reality. There's no escape from wisdom. But the faith follower is one whose main motivation, whose driving force, is faith and aspiration. So the faith follower hears the teaching from the Buddha, or learns the teaching, and then out of devotion to the Buddha, out of faith in the Buddha, trust in the Dhamma, the faith follower will then undertake the practice, and then through the practice, their wisdom will mature, and when the wisdom is sharp enough, then they will step over that boundary line and become an actual faith follower. Okay, and so in the case of the Dhamma follower and the faith follower, they acquire the five faculties of the noble person. And then they develop those five faculties. And when those five faculties, that's faith, energy, mindfulness, concentration, and wisdom, when the five faculties are sufficiently developed, then they make the breakthrough to the world transcending Dhamma, and they become stream enterers. And that breakthrough always has to occur within the very same life in which they become a Dhamma follower or a faith follower. Okay, so after making that statement, then the Buddha calls attention to himself as being the qualified teacher. He says, I am skilled in this world, skilled in the other world, skilled in Mara's realm, and so on. Then it will lead to, for those who think that they should listen to me and place faith in me, this will lead to their welfare and happiness for a long time. Okay, and then after saying this, then the Buddha basically states the same point that he makes in the sutta in a series of verses. They don't need explanation. You can just read on your own. Okay, now I'll ask whether there's any questions on this sutta. Please don't be shy about asking. Okay, George.
Whenever it refers to the realm of death,
yeah.
I don't remember running across that a lot.
Matyudaya. This expression, realm of death, one doesn't come across it so often in prose passages. One gets it fairly often in verses. They come in verses in the Samyutta Nikaya. The expression might come in the Dhammapada.
Does it mean more than samsara?
It pretty much refers to samsara. Samsara considered to be under the control of death. Or did you think of some other meaning it might have?
No, I was wondering. I didn't know. I mean, it's distinguished from Mara's realm.
It's actually the same thing as Mara's realm. In Pali, the realm of death is Matyudaya. And Matyu and Mara are almost the same word. Mara, in fact, is called Matyu Raja, the king of death. Okay, Peter?
I'm thinking about the Buddha's analogy between sending cattle across a ford and then the ordering of the humans in this case.
Yeah.
And I guess the rationale with the cattle is to send the strongest ones in first to see if they can muster the strength to get through, or I know you don't know about cattle. I don't either. But I'm wondering in the case of the followers of the Dhamma, is he describing who gets across first or who should attempt to go across first?
Is that applying to human beings?
Yes. Is there a similar rationale that might apply?
Okay, in the case of the cattle, whether cowherds actually send the cattle across in a particular order, again, that I don't know. And to myself, intuitively, it doesn't quite make so much sense. Especially since, do you have experience with cattle? You do.
Well,
maybe you should be giving the lecture tonight.
It's just that my cousin raised heifers, and I asked her a lot of questions when she was alive about heifers. And it's just funny that he would send the bulls and presumably the male elders first, because anyone who has a herd knows that the dominant cow of a herd is the female.
The heifer is a female?
No, heifer is a 1-year-old cow.
Oh.
But whoever is the dominant cow,
yeah,
it's always a female. She won't even take the boy, even over the bull. The dominant cow will be a female cow.
The female is dominant over the bull.
One female is going to be the dominant.
Hmm. Oh.
and she will lead them wherever they're supposed to go.
Okay, so I learned something new about...
Maybe that's American cows.
Yeah. I don't know who to contact. Yeah. We had some Indian visitors a few days ago. They're not here now, so not so easy to find out about the behavior of Indian cows now. But I'll inquire. Anyway, the reason why the cows are ordered, put into this particular order, is to draw the parallel with the human beings who get across. And then the reason for that particular ordering is by the order of who is, let's say, who is further advanced along on the way to liberation. So the arhats are already across. Then come the non-returners who have eliminated the five fetters and don't come back even to this sensuous realm. Then the once-returners who come back one more time. The stream-enterers who come back even up to seven times. And then the Dhamma follower or faith follower who still, who in this life will become stream-enterers but have not yet done so.
So maybe the idea is that the bulls are the best prepared to cross the stream.
Yeah, well, they're the strongest, and at least the way the Buddha envisages a herd of cattle, the bulls are the ones who go in front. Suki, you have something to contribute about cattle raising?
But I just want to make it clear about the Dhamma followers and faith followers.
To make it clear about the faith follower and the Dhamma follower.
Right. Did you say these two followers are already noble disciples?
I said that two are already considered Arya Pugala's noble disciples.
So that means that they are who enter the stream but not actually have a fruit of stream.
Okay, this is a good point in the technical language. Yeah, they are called, sometimes a distinction is made between one who is practicing for the realization of the fruit and one who has attained the fruit. So there's one practicing for the realization of the fruit of stream entry, and then the stream enterer. So the faith follower and the Dhamma follower, those are two subdivisions of the person who is practicing for realization of the fruit of stream entry. Yes, Marcy?
And then there's this idea of acquiring the five faculties of the noble person.
Yeah.
It's my understanding that at stream entry, all five of these are balanced, these faculties or something of that nature. So what is acquiring the five faculties of to make the Dhamma Nisari and the Sadha Nisari noble persons?
Actually, one always has, let us say when one is practicing and cultivating, one has the five faculties. This is what one is developing. But it's just that what happens with when one becomes a faith follower or a Dhamma follower is that the five faculties undergo what one might call a qualitative change, that they become now the five faculties, which are the faculties of a noble person. What's interesting is the question, what is it that marks the transition from an ordinary person to being a Dhamma follower or a faith follower? And the way it's stated in the text, I have to say it doesn't give like a very clear, definitive, indubitable criterion to mark the distinction. What is said is that there's a sutta which says, the eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind are impermanent, changing, and becoming otherwise. One who places faith in such teachings and resolves upon them becomes, is a faith follower, one who has transcended the level of the ordinary person, entered the realm of the noble ones, and is incapable of taking a rebirth in the three lower realms, and is incapable of passing away without realizing the fruit of stream entry. Okay, that is the faith follower. The Dhamma follower, the description begins in the same way. The eye, ear, nose, tongue, body, mind are impermanent, changing, becoming otherwise. One who understands these teachings to a certain extent with wisdom, is this one is called a Dhamma follower. Again, one who has transcended the plane of the ordinary person, entered the plane of the noble ones, is incapable of taking a lower rebirth, and is incapable of passing away without realizing the fruit of stream entry. But somebody who is, say, practicing meditation on impermanence can say, well, I accept these teachings through faith, so I must be a faith follower, or I have some understanding of these teachings, so I must be a Dhamma follower. So I don't see an incontrovertible criterion to mark the transition. Okay, I think we'll have to stop for this evening. So let us now share the merits. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu sasanang. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu desanang. Akasa ta jabuma ta deva naga mahitika punyantang anumoditva chirang rakantu mang parang. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe deva anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe bhutanumodantu sabba sampati siddhya. Etavata cha amhehi sampadang punya sampadang. Sabbe sata anumodantu sabba sampati siddhya.